Okay.
As I told Mr. Schwartzbaum in the elevator, I am very, very excited to give this particular class because the entire edifice of this lecture series was created for the sole purpose of giving this particular class. I really wanted to speak about this topic and in particular develop the findings that we're going to explore this evening. And I just sort of, out of that, grew a framework that serendipitously picked up where last year's semester left off. But that's neither here nor there. What we discussed last time, if you'll recall, is the extent to which we can speak about different issues as impinging on the question or informing the question of sectarianism. So just without recapping, because formally it's not connected, but just as a matter of continuity, what we saw last time was that there are certain issues that we take for granted as constituting a communal consciousness nowadays. For example, and in particular, the calendar, as sort of creating the rhythms and flow of a modern Jewish community. And what we saw last time was that, in fact, this was not necessarily the case. There were some groups who maintained, or rather, within the context of early Judaism in the late Second Temple period, there were those who maintained wildly different calendars and somehow managed not to let that become a contentious issue. And in fact, as we'll see in a couple of classes, the issue of the Jewish calendar and how to reckon it does not become an issue until, on the one hand, Chazal make it into an issue, and on the other hand, the Christians make it into an issue in terms of calculating the proper date of Easter at the Council of Nicaea. People forget, at the Council of Nicaea in 325, which is sort of the birth of modern Christianity, so to speak, the agenda number one on the issue was defining the nature of Yeshu. Item number two on the agenda was the calendar. Right. So we'll get to those top three items in a couple of classes. Now, what I'd like to do is transition from last class to address the question of, I think that is most near and dear to our hearts, and that is the place of the Pharisees within the matrix of ancient Judaism that we've been laying out and analyzing so far. Why is this of interest to us? So the obvious answer is, why do we care about the Pharisees? The simple answer. Right. We are the conventional wisdom holds that we are descended from the Pharisees, intellectually, spiritually. I would be remiss if I didn't mention the debate over this question. It's not so cut and dry. The reason I say this is because although we take it for granted that Chazal equals Pharisees, this isn't necessarily intuitively obvious from the sources. The reason I say this is because there is no point in rabbinic literature at which anyone ever says, in which any Rav and any rabbi ever says, I am a Pharisee. No rabbi is ever identified as a Prushi. And moreover, the Pharisees, although they don't seem to call themselves rabbis, the only people who seem to call the Pharisees rabbis are the writers of the Gospels. And that's of no help to us because they also call Jesus a rabbi, even though he certainly was not a Pharisee, as we'll see this evening. What cuts against that, on the other hand, is the fact that there are figures who play a prominent role in rabbinic literature, who in Josephus and in the New Testament are identified positively, and presumably we should not question this, as Pharisees, and yet in Chazal, in particular in the Mishnah, are given the title Rav. The two most famous of these characters are Rabban Gamliel and Rabban Shimon ben Gamliel. Rabban Gamliel in the New Testament is described as a Pharisee and a member of the Sanhedrin. In Chazal, of course, he's Rabban Gamliel. He's Gamliel, our rabbi. And Shimon Gamliel is Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel. And Josephus identifies him in his autobiography as a Pharisee. And in fact, records conversations that he had with Shimon ben Gamliel, which is an interesting thing in and of itself. There are source sheets in the middle over there.
Right. Rabbi Shammai.
So the Tosefta tells us Galdem Rav and Shmo. It's more important who you are than what your title is. But and in fact, that's the New Testament makes a very similar point, although in a more contentious and hostile fashion. The question is, when does the title Rabbi as a construct appear? It's an open question. The evidence that we have based on the Mishnah would tell us that the title generates rather early, not as early as the Mishnah's memory goes back in terms of rabbinic figures. You have people like Ben Zoma or Ben Azai who don't have rabbi attached to their name at all, even at a rather late date. And even further, as you mentioned, Hillel HaZaken, Shammai, and so on and so forth, you don't have the name rabbi. But you do have Rabban Gamliel, Rabbi Shimon Ben Gamliel. So in sort of the late first generation of Tanaim, you already have the title Rav. As we're going to discuss in a couple of classes, we actually have records, epigraphical records, which means sort of inscriptions, that preserve the names of people with the title rabbi. And the question is, none of those people, in fact, appear anywhere in rabbinic literature. So we're going to have to examine what the title rabbi, rabbi or ribi, would have meant in the context of ancient Jewish history. But what that shouldn't detain us now. What we're going to discuss here is the Pharisees. Now, as I mentioned, it's not intuitively obvious that rabbis are Pharisees. However, what cuts against this, and we'll hold this as decisive for now, for lack of time, and that is that there's so many ways in which the halacha of the Prushim matches up with the halacha of the rabbis. Moreover, in disputes between Prushim, Pharisees, and other groups, the rabbinic literature always defends the Prushim and always sides with them against other groups. And as I said, there are individuals who we know were Pharisees who are identified by rabbinic literature as rabbis. So, although it's not dispositive, it gives us some grounds to postulate that there is this genetic or a generative relationship between, on the one hand, Purushim, and on the other hand, Chazal. In the cases that we're going to examine, this issue is actually a moot point, because we're going to examine disputes between the Pharisees and other groups, in which we paskin halakha l'maisa, like the Pharisees. Now, why is this important? What I want to get at here is sort of to lay the groundwork for our examination of what precisely it was that distinguished the Pharisees and later on Chazal, the rabbis, not just in their own eyes, but in the eyes of those who attacked them and who disagreed with them. What was it that people saw as the project of Chazal? In other words, it's very easy for us, and if we think in our own context, it's often, it's not just easy, but it's ideal and laudable for us to shine a light on our own problems and attempt to develop sort of a positive expression of what it means to be, let's say, a modern Orthodox Jew or a Manhattan Jew or an Orthodox Jew, all of the identities that we at one point or another espouse. But often, if a person wants to know what it is to be a modern Orthodox Jew who espouses the tenets of what we would, broadly speaking, call Torah Umada, it's often helpful to look at places or look at sources or examine contexts in which that brand of Judaism is forced to defend itself from attacks, because it gives you an idea of what the alternatives are, and it allows us, therefore, to crystallize what we mean when we say a person is a modern Orthodox Jew and so on and so forth. So, in a similar vein, what I'd like to do is take different contexts in which the Pharisees, the Prushim, are attacked by other groups. We did this superficially, for those who were here, we did this somewhat superficially last semester. Just for lack of time, we were covering Essenes, Sadducees, and Pharisees all in the same class. We're going to have a little bit more time to sort of luxuriate in the sources and read them very critically. And what I'd like to argue, and I hope you'll bear with me through the argument, because it is, I hope, complex. What I'd like to argue is that when we look at the sum total of attacks on the Pharisees, and I essentially have given you every single one that we have, for the most part, that are explicit this evening. When we look at the attacks on the Pharisees by rival groups, which might be Sadducees, which might be followers of Jesus, and so on and so forth, what we're going to find is not just one, but several common denominators. And those common denominators, I believe, will allow us to sharpen our definition of what it means to be a Pharisee, eventually a rabbi, and all the way down to our day, what it means to be a rabbinic Jew, to be a firm Jew. Source number one I've already given you in a previous class, but it bears repeating here because it's by far the most famous source in antiquity on the Pharisees, and it's shaped all scholarship on this question from the turn of the millennium to today, and that is source number one. Josephus in the Jewish War, and also elsewhere, tells us he sets up a tripartite division of ancient Judaism. We've seen this already, so we can run through it. Josephus says, Jewish philosophy, in fact, takes three forms. The followers of the first school are called Pharisees, of the second Sadducees, and of the third Essenes. We've examined the Essenes in some detail. The Sadducees we'll leave for another time. And the Pharisees are going to be the focus of our inquiry tonight. Now, as we noted in previous classes, it's not obvious, and in fact it's likely incorrect, to assume that when Josephus says there are three schools of Judaism, that means that there are only three schools of Judaism. In fact, what Josephus is doing here is giving us a simplified picture of intellectual ferment within the Jewish community that he is going to present to his Gentile readers. But what we can take away from this is that there is one prominent group amongst the three, and presumably prominent within, and this is supported by other sources, prominent within the intellectual, theological context of the late Second Temple period, that is the Pharisees. And what we're going to do is examine two sources, or two corpuses that give us a hint of what it was that people found objectionable about the Pharisees. The reason I think this is important is because Josephus, I didn't give this to you on your source material, Josephus says that the Pharisees were the most popular of all of the parties. It doesn't mean that they were the leaders of the Jewish people at this time, which is what is sometimes assumed. In fact, it almost certainly doesn't mean that, but it does mean that they were regarded by the people well. And that their advice was sought on many different questions. So now, what we're going to do is begin with within a historical context, a famous source from the very end of Maseches Yadayim, the tractate of the Mishnah that deals with the impurity that the rabbis assign to people's hands. Midoraisa, from the perspective of Torah law, a person cannot become anything less than a Rishon Latuma. What this means in terms of the laws of purity is that there is the highest form of impurity, which is of course corpse impurity, which is called an Avi Avos Atuma, the granddaddy of all impurity. Below that, and essentially on the same level with respect to many laws, are things that are called just a regular Avatuma, a father of impurity. These would be things like an animal corpse with meat on it, and so on and so forth. If you come into contact with one of those things, you become a Vlad Hatoma, a child of impurities. A child of impurity can be graded as follows. The first step is Rishon Hatoma, and then Sheni, Shlishi, and Ravi, and so on and so forth. So you could be a first step removed from Tuma, a second step, and so on and so forth. The rabbis decreed that although a person cannot become anything less then a Rishon Latuma, food and Shruma and sacrificial food can become something more than that, but a person on a Torah level cannot become anything less than one level removed from Tuma. However, the rabbis decreed that for various reasons that a person's hands should always be considered a Sheni Latuma, should be considered a second degree removed from Tuma, and therefore you have to be careful about the sorts of things that you touch. In Maseches Yadayim, this is the tractate that deals with these laws. Now, what I've done is I've given you at the very end of the tractate, there is a series of three Mishnayos where the Mishnah depicts a dispute between the Pharisees and their interlocutors, the Sadducees. And in one case, it's another group. We'll explore what that means in a moment. What we're going to do is we're going to analyze the first and the third dispute. There are four disputes in all. The first and the third dispute. And then we're going to analyze the second and the fourth dispute. I believe that those categories actually reflect structural similarities. What I'd like to do is read the texts, attempt to identify what the structure of the argument is. And then what we're going to do after that is attempt to figure out what it was that bothered the Sadducees about the position espoused by the Pharisees. And we're going to go through each case and perform the same operation. And in the end, we're going to have to ask ourselves, are there common denominators between all of the criticisms or among all of the criticisms of the Pharisees? And then what we're going to do after that is look at another source, namely the Gospels, where we're going to have to see if these common denominators present themselves as well. So, if you look in source number two, and just a brief comment, because a couple of people have asked me in the past, I've given you in the left-hand column, not a Bar-Ilan text, I've given you a manuscript text. The reason I do this is because the text of the Mishnah that we have in, let's say, our printed editions that we have in Bar-Ilan is a corrupt text. It reflects Christian censorship of the Talmud in many instances in the 16th century, and then when those correct, and when the censorship was, when people tried to correct the censorship, they made many more errors than they did the first time. The printed text also reflects an amalgamation and mixing up of two different forms of the Mishnah that we have. By and large, there are two recensions of the Mishnah. One is in Eretz Yisrael and one is in Bavel. The printed text sort of mixes and mashes them up. The manuscript that I've given you here, this is just, I'll do this briefly because it's boring and I'll move on. The best manuscript usually is called the Kaufman manuscript, Xaviat Kaufman. I will normally give you the Kaufman manuscript because it's the best and it reflects what would have been the spoken Hebrew of people in the second century of Eretz Yisrael, which is a very ancient and therefore excellent text. For Seder Taharos, which Mishnah Yedaim is a part, I've given you the Parma manuscript, Parma B. The reason is because this manuscript, you'll notice it has vowels in it. The vowels were put in by the same person who wrote the manuscript, and he wrote the manuscript in the 12th century, the Common Era, which means that this is the oldest form of a vocalized Mishnah that we have. And therefore, this is a very important manuscript. So in terms of reading the text of the Mishnah, it's always best to use all the manuscripts together, but it's best to use as accurate a manuscript as you can. We don't have time to go through all of the different manuscripts, so I've given you a good one on the left-hand side. Okay. Now, as we read this, I'm going to read it and translate it. As we read it, keep in your mind the structure of the rhetorical structure of the argument, and then we're going to try and identify what it is, and then we're going to analyze. Okay, the text begins, Omrim Tzidukin. The Sadducees say, Kovlan anu aleichem prushim, we protest against you, O Pharisees. Why? Sha'atem omrim kisvei hakodesh metamen asayadayim, v'sifrei homerus einan metamen asayadayim. You believe, Pharisees, that, much like hands, the decree of the rabbis, and presumably of the Pharisees, was not just that hands are given a rabbinical level of impurity, but also the scrolls of Torah scrolls, not just Torah scrolls, but most likely all scrolls of any work in Tanakh. They are also given a level of impurity, a sheni level of impurity, second removed from the highest, and they render impurity unto other things, midra banan. So we protest against you because you think, Pharisees, that the holiest scriptures that we have are impure, whereas the same Gezerah was not made for other books. The example that they give here is Hameras, which is the sort of Hebraicized form of Homer. The books of Homer, Iliad, the Odyssey, these works do not make other things impure. So that's the argument that the Sadducees render against the Pharisees. The Pharisees decreed that Kisvei HaKodesh, that holy books, the Tanakh, should have impurity, but the books of Homer should not. So Amar Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai. So Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, analyzing this argument many years later, said to his Talmidim, he said, "V'chi ein lanu ala prushim ela zo bilvad." Is this the only thing that's wrong with the position of the Pharisees? What else do they say? The Harei Hein Omrim. They also say, "Atzmos chamar tahorin v'atzmos Yochanan kohen gadol tamei." The bones of a donkey are pure. In other words, Chazal have and presumably the Pharisees have a decree that when the Torah says that the corpse of a dead animal is impure, that only applies to a corpse that has meat on it, at least an olive's amount of meat. But if it doesn't, if it's just bones, it's not impure at all. So they restricted the impurity of animal corpses to the meat. So the bones of a donkey, a mundane, disgusting animal, are pure, but the bones of a human being, and for emphasis, Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai mentions Yochanan the high priest, probably John Hyrcanus, one of the Hasmonean Kohanim Gedolim, the bones of the Kohen Gadol himself are impure, because the Torah tells us that a corpse is impure. So how can you Pharisees say that the bones of a disgusting animal are pure, but the bones of the high priest are impure? How could that be? So Amru, so presumably Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai's students, students responded to him, "L'vichi basan hitu masan shalayase adam atzmos aviv'imo tarvados." Really, the degree of impurity that something possesses is related to how dear it is, at least in some cases, to how dear it is to God. And therefore, Presumably, the reason why the bones of a human being have impurity is because we love human beings. Kadosh Baruch Hu loves human beings. The bones of an animal are not nearly as important to God, and therefore they do not render things impure. So the principle is, lefi chibasan hi tumasan. According to their dearness is their impurity. So Amar Lahen, af kisvei ha-kodesh, lefi chibasan hi tumasan. V'sivri hamrash, einan chavivin, einan metamen ha-sayadayim. So the same principle is true for holy scriptures. In other words, the books of Tanakh are impure. Why? Because they're beloved. Because they're the books of Tanakh. They're holy. They're kisvei ha-kodesh. The books of Homer are not nearly as important as the books of Scripture, however important they may be, but because they don't have that level of importance, they don't contract and therefore render impurity to anything else. So that is the argument that that is made on behalf of the Pharisees. Now, just a parenthetical note, the Rishonim and the Acharonim interpret this middle section of Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai when he says, the other thing that the Purushim do wrong is that they say that the bones of an animal are pure, whereas the bones of the high priest are impure. Most people assume that what Rabbi Yochanan, and this is important for the structure, most people assume that what Rabbi Yochanan Zakkai was saying there was, well, you Sadducees presumably agree that the bones of an animal are pure, whereas the bones of a human being are impure. Certainly, you agree with that position of the Pharisees, and if you agree with that, then you have to agree with the Pharisees about Kisvei HaKodesh as well. The problem is that we know that this isn't true. Why? Because we know that Chazal were unique in thinking that bones were pure, that just because the corpse didn't have meat on it, that therefore it was pure. How do we know that? Take a look at source number two. This is one of the Dead Sea Scrolls, the Temple Scroll. There are many scholars who assume that this is actually written by Sadducees, this text. That's substantially less clear to me, but nonetheless, it gives us a valuable perspective on this issue. They say explicitly, v'chol anosei me'atzmo seimo, v'niv la'seimo, or ubasar v'chulei, v'chibes begadav, v'rachatz mayim uva shemesh achar yitar. It essentially says, now, anyone who carries the bones, in this case of one of the impure animals, on their corpse, the skin or the flesh or the claws shall wash his clothes and bathe in water. The sun will set, and afterwards he will be pure. So here it is explicitly stated that even if the corpse only consists of bones, it's still impure. So Chazal were an anomaly in this respect. So now that we know this, let's think about the structure of this argument right here. What sort of argument, if we had to characterize it in Lumdish terms, in sort of rabbinic terms, what sort of argument did the Sadducees make against the rabbis? They seem to be saying that if the books of Homer are pure, then the books of Tanakh should certainly be pure. What sort of argument is that in rabbinic terms? It's kal v'chomer, right? They're making a kal v'chomer argument, saying if these mundane books are pure, then certainly these holy books should be pure as well. Now, implicit in that assumption, this will be important for, this is really the point of this class, implicit in that assumption is what? What are they assuming about how purity and impurity works? The Sadducees.
It's better to be pure.
Right.
That it implies a higher status to the object if it's pure.
Right, exactly. In other words, something that is more important to us should sort of parallel or have a direct relationship with its purity status. In other words, the more important something, the more pure it is. The less important, the less pure it should be. So what are the Sadducees accusing the rabbis, or rather the Pharisees, of doing? Of upending this order. They're misunderstanding the relationship between Tumah v'Tahara and something's importance. Right? Now, rhetorically, from the point of view of rhetorical structure, how does this work? The Sadducees make a kal v'chomer, and the rabbis, or somebody on behalf of the Pharisees, responds by doing what? So what do the Pharisees do in response? What I'd argue is that they attempt to reconfigure how we view Tumah v'Tahara, right? They make the argument that you, in fact, Sadducees, have misunderstood Tumah v'Tahara. And really, it's possible, not always necessary, but it's possible that lafi chibasan tumasan, according to something's dearness, is its impurity. Now, is this always the case? Lafi chibasan tumasan? What about a sheretz? Right, a creepy crawly thing. A creepy crawly thing is impure. right? Does that mean that therefore HaKadosh Baruch Hu loves rats and mice more than he loves human beings? Presumably this is not the case. God loves all of his creatures, but in terms of ontological importance, one would assume that a human being has a higher status than a rat. So it's not always true, l'fichi basan mikumasan. So what are Chazal saying? Rather, what are the Pharisees saying here?
That phrase, what you didn't say, suggests that the reason for having something, quote, impure is for there to be hands off. You can't mess with it. You can't use it for, you know, for making spoons out of bones.
Right. So that's another one. So that's something else that we'll examine. So in the case of the, I think there are two responses here. In terms of the bones, right, so the response that the students give to the bones seems somewhat different than the response that they give to the books. Right, with respect to the bones, why are the bones of your parents, impure, but of your pet, those bones are pure? Why is that? Right, practically speaking, people made, especially in antiquity, people made utensils out of bones. Right, out of bone utensils. In fact, there are all these halachos about whether or not you have to tovel, whether or not you have to ritually immerse bone utensils. So because we don't want people to mistreat human bones, so we upend the rules of Tumah V'Tahara for that purpose. So it seems that there are really two things that the Pharisees are doing here. One, they're making a practical point. They're saying, if we follow your position, Sadducees, as internally consistent as it may be, we're going to arrive at an absolutely impractical reality, which is that people will just use the bones of their parents the way that they use the bones of anybody else. In other words, if animal bones are pure, certainly human being bones should be pure, then people are going to make utensils out of their parents' bones, which is certainly not a desirable result.
They use it as relics.
Right.
You know, it wasn't necessarily to disgrace the bone, but, you know, if it's in their home, it's like a relic.
Right.
I mean, obviously, in our minds, it's a disgrace, but they may not have thought of it that way.
Right, so maybe they...
jewelry,
right?
And have wearing it as jewelry. We would think that's disgusting, but they didn't think that they thought that was like it's a relic.
Right, so it's possible that people would have done that. What the Pharisees seem concerned about is that people would use it for mundane objects as well. And then the other point that they make is not just are we worried about practical reality and the practical concerns, we're also attempting to show you that the way that Sally characterized the Sadducean position is not adopted by the Pharisees. Why? Because the Pharisees are saying, you assume that there must be this direct relationship between how important something is and how pure it is. Really, that's not correct. Things are vastly more complicated. Something may be impure, not because it's less important, but because it's far more dear to us and we want to protect it. In this case, we want to protect people from misusing the books of Tanakh, and therefore we make them impure to protect them. So those are two points that the Pharisees have made here. One, we need to worry about practical realities far more than the Sadducees do, and B, we need to reconfigure our entire understanding of Tumah V'Tahara. Okay, that's what we get from source number two here. Now take a look at source number four. Which should be the Mishnah Yadayim 4:7b. Okay. This is the third dispute between the Pharisees and the Sadducees in the Mishnah, and I believe that it should be grouped together with the one that we just read. Now let's see why. Omrim Tzidukin. All right, so the Sadducees say, Kovlin anu aleichem prushim, they use the same language. We protest against you, O Pharisees. Ma im shori v'chamori she'eni chayev behen mitzvos, hari ani chayev beniskan. They say, the rule is as follows. If a person has an animal that damages someone else's property, you are responsible for paying for that damage. However, that's a clear law in the Torah, and that's an unassailable position. If your animal commits damage, you, the owner, are responsible for paying for it. However, what happens if your servant commits damage? That is substantially less clear. The position of the Pharisees seems to have been that you are not responsible for the damage that they cause. If your servant causes damage to somebody else, he is responsible to pay the price. Now, the Sadducees make the following argument. an animal whose observance of mitzvos, which is nil, you are not responsible for maintaining or for assuring compliance. So for an animal for whom you have no responsibility for mitzvah observance, you have to pay for their damages. And certainly, a servant who's a fellow member of the covenant, for whom you do have a responsibility, you should certainly have to pay for damages that they commit. Why? The position of the Sadducees seems to have been that paying for somebody's damages is part and parcel of your responsibility to make sure that they observe mitzvahs. In other words, you have to... the Torah says it's halchayach tochiach asamisecha, right? You have to make sure that you criticize your fellow Jew to make sure that he or she are properly observing mitzvos. So too, paying for them and being responsible for their actions, for their damages, is part and parcel of the responsibility that each person bears towards his or her fellow Jew. So the argument runs as follows: for an animal for whom you have no responsibility, you still are responsible for their damages. Then certainly for a human being for whom you do bear responsibility, you should certainly pay for their damages. Now, what sort of argument is this? It's a Kal Vachomer. Again, a Kal Vachomer. So the Sadducees open with a Kal Vachomer attack on the rabbis. This should already hint to us, I think, that rather on the Pharisees. This should already hint to us that we should be looking, perhaps, for the same common denominator as we found in the previous case. Now, what do the rabbis respond? The rabbis respond in a similar manner to above. They completely reconfigure how we think about the relationship between a man and his beast on the one hand and a man and his servant on the other hand by making what sort of argument? What sort of argument is made here? So the rabbis say, bear in mind how the rabbis are responding. They say, Amar Lahen, the Pharisees replied, Lo, im amartem b'shori v'chamori she'ein behen das, Tomron ba'avdi of Amasi sheyesh behem das shemaknitenu yelach v'yad lekedisho shav achar ve'chayev l'shalom. An animal has no intellectual capacity, and I can distinguish between an animal and a human being. A human being has his own independent intellectual capacity. So, in other words, why am I obligated to pay for an animal's damage? Because he can't pay for himself. He has no intellectual capacity. But for a human being, he's an independent reasoner. In other words, he has a sense of independence all his own. So I'm not responsible to pay for him. Moreover, if you were to make a human being responsible for paying for the damages that his manservant or maidservant causes, what's the person going to do? Anytime you're mean to your servant, the person is going to just get back at you by lighting someone else's house on fire, and you're going to be on the hook for the money. So there are two arguments that the Pharisees make here. One, and what sort of arguments are they? The second one, I think similar to the one we made above,
is that it's degrading to that person.
Right. Right. In other words, right, it's degrading.
So that person can't make a good decision, so then they're just going to go and not make any decisions.
Right. So as Malvina said, it's practical. In other words, we are concerned that if we don't legislate in this fashion, whether or not it's correct in a first principle sense, if we legislate this way, slaves are just going to go around destroying people's property willy-nilly, and the master is going to be on the hook for it. So there's one practical argument. The second argument that's made...
I don't buy that.
Why?
Because realistically, whether you distinguish between a slave or an employee, if somebody who's in your employ screws up and does something, you are responsible for it.
Right.
Because the slave has no way of paying for it. The slave has sold himself into slavery because he owes you money.
Right.
And how is the slave ever going to pay somebody else out?
Right, right. In other words, right.
But the question is that are you putting an animal and a slave on the same level? If you say that a human being has to pay like an animal, then an animal and a slave are on the same level.
You're not
elevating the human being to anything higher than the animal or whatever you're saying.
Exactly. So I think that's the second point that the Pharisees are making. The Sadducees had assumed, so just to address Ira's point in one second, what the Sadducees had assumed is that in terms of how we value a thing, responsibility for it must mean responsibility to assure its compliance with the laws of damages equals how important it is. Right? In other words, the more important something is, the more we are required to pay for its damages. So animals have X importance, and we have to pay for their damages. So human beings who have X times 500 importance, we certainly have to pay for their damages. So Mr. Schwartzman's pointing out is that what we have to reassess, the Pharisees say, is that equation. It's not true that the more important something is, the more we have to pay for its damages. In fact, perhaps we might think about it in the converse way. In other words, the less intellectual capacity something has, the more we are responsible for it. So in other words, the rabbis are saying things are complicated. Just like we said with purity and impurity, things are more complicated. Sometimes the more dear it is, the more impure it is. So too here. Sometimes it's true that the more important something is, the more responsibility you have towards it. Kol Yisrael Arevim Zeh Bazeh. Right? Every Jew is responsible for every other Jew. But sometimes there are some things, like animals, who have no ability to take care of themselves, and so we have to take care of them, whereas human beings have independent agency, and we expect them to be responsible for themselves. So the Pharisees are saying here, as a matter of first principles, it's important not to make these one-to-one Manichaean assumptions that the Sadducees are making. Right, ein ladavar sof, right? We could take this to an extreme. So now, with respect to Ira's point, in other words, it's true it may cut both ways. In other words, how is a slave to pay for this? How is a servant to pay for this? So that's a question that Chazal deal with. In other words, what sort of responsibility is attendant here and how can they pay for it? But just in principle, we can imagine ways that they might make it up. In other words, work for that person for a little bit, or pay them back in kind, or owe them when you're free. But we can imagine all sorts of schemes that Chazal later might have come up with. But if we were to adopt a system where the master is always on hook for the servant's actions, then we can always imagine a scenario where sort of a disgruntled servant could cause his master untold amounts of damage and get off scot-free.
It also, it seems to me that if you pay for the servant's damage, then the servant has no incentive to act properly, to obey the mitzvot, and so you're not being responsible for the servant obeying the mitzvot, because you're in a situation where it's easier for the servant not to obey.
Right. And in fact, Chazal later develop an entire principle that's based on that sort of logic, which is Ein Shliach L'Dvar Aveira. There's no such thing as agency from one person to another with respect to an evil deed. So in other words, if I tell Reuven to kill somebody, so Reuven can't say, well, I killed him, but it was Ari's fault because he sent me. You can't say that. In other words, there's no such thing as agency when it comes to an evil deed. Each person has their own independent sense of agency. So now, I think we can identify a common denominator so far in how people are attacking the Pharisees. The Pharisees are being accused of completely upending these familiar categories of how things are valued in terms of purity and impurity. In other words, the Pharisees are mixing up things that should be pure with things that should be impure, and in terms of human versus animal dignity. In other words, the Pharisees are also mixing up things in that realm as well. And the Pharisees are responding by pointing A, to practical concerns, the practical reality, and our need to take it into account, and B, by pointing out that these first principles are not always as simplistic as the Sadducees are making things out to be. Now, look at source number five. Source number five and source number six also have these parallels one to the other. And bear in mind here what the structure is, because it's different than the structure above. So Omrim Tzidukin, Kovlin Anu Aleichem Prushim, Sha'atem Metaren Asanitzok. The Sadducees protest against the Pharisees as follows. And they say, we disagree with you. Why? Because in a case where you have a pure vessel and you pour liquid from it to an impure vessel, so the impurity is on the bottom. So according to the Sadducees, anything that is, even the vessel on top, which is pure, becomes impure. Why? Because when you're pouring from one vessel to another, that creates a connection between the two vessels. And even though in the sense of gravity, we would expect that Tumah shouldn't be able to travel upwards. Whenever you have two things that are connected, the top vessel and the bottom vessel, by a stream of water, the impurity goes to both of them. Why? The Sadducees seem to have assumed, based on this, that any time you have a body of water that has impurity anywhere in it, even if it's totally upstream, the whole thing is impure. Now, the rabbis, we know, the Pharisees, tell us that in such a case, if you're pouring something impure into something pure, the whole thing is ruined. But if the impurity is only on the bottom, connecting stream is not enough to make the impurity travel all the way upstream into the top vessel. Okay, technical details aside. So the Prushim respond, the Pharisees respond. Omer Prushim, Kovlam Anu Aleichem Tzdukim. We protest against you, Sadducees. Why? Sha'atem Mitarenes Amas Hamayim Haba Ben Akvaros. Because you believe that when you have a stream that flows and flows and flows, let's say through a graveyard, and somehow contracts impurity, say it flows under an overhang, so it contracts impurity from the dead bodies, and it coalesces at the end into a pool full of rainwater. So what would that pool be considered? A mikvah, right? So that pool is a mikvah. Now, ach mayonu bor mikvei mayim yetahar. The Torah tells us that a mikvah, by definition, is always pure. Always, 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 always pure, at least from a Torah perspective. And therefore, if you have water that is impure from, let's say, corpses, that's flowing into a mikvah, what is the law? The Torah says it explicitly. It's pure. There's nothing that can ruin that. Now, we know, the rabbis admit to this as well, that if a person, let's say a person who has corpse impurity, takes water from out of its source in the ground where it was pure, and now touches it and drinks from it, so now the water pours it back in. Now there is water that is impure that is now in the water. So in such a case, so you can well imagine a person walking up to, let's say, a natural sort of a canal in a town, and this is a very common thing in the Second Temple period. You would have canals that would bring water into the water holes, and people would drink from it. So let's say a person who has contracted corpse impurity walks up to the stream, takes a little bit out, and pours it back in. Takes a drink out of it, and then pours the rest back into the stream. Common enough occurrence. In that case, what do we have? We have impurity, impure water, that is mixed in with the entire water supply of the city. Now, if the Sadducees' position is taken to its logical conclusion, which is, and namely, their position is that any time there's any impurity connected to water in any way, the whole thing is impure, then all water in all water sources should be impure, including, in this case, in a source like a mikvah, that the Torah explicitly says is pure, no matter what. It must be, therefore, that the Sadducees concede that point of Torah law with respect to the mikvah. And if that's true, there's an inconsistency in the Sadducee position. Namely, that whereas with respect to a mikvah, they're willing to concede that sometimes there may be impurity in a water source, but doesn't mean the whole thing is ruined. So too, say the Pharisees, in the case of a stream of impurity. Just because there's impurity on the bottom doesn't mean there should necessarily be impurity on the top. Now, before we examine what exactly is going on here, what is the structure? The structure seems different. Is there a Kal V'Chomer here?
No.
I don't think so. All the Sadducees say is, you espouse the following halachic position, and we don't like that. Now, the Pharisees respond by doing what? Do they sort of redefine how we think about Tumah V'Tahara? No, what do they do? What's the rhetorical strategy that they use? Right. In other words, that's what Andy said. Did everyone hear Andy? In other words, they take a law that everybody agrees to, Pharisees and Sadducees, and say, if you believe this law, then you certainly must, then you can't attack our position, because our position is the same as that position.
But can you just make the argument that that is something that is a problem for us?
Right. So let's pursue that for a second. Right. The counter argument that Ira is pointing out is that you could say this isn't the law of a mikvah is an exception to this rule. So what does this question assume? In other words, what is the problem that the Sadducees are? Meaning, in other words, on what grounds are the Sadducees attacking the Pharisees? They could have picked any number of laws that the Pharisees hold. Why is this one important? Now, what are they arguing by saying, in other words, what are they telling the Pharisees by telling them, we have a problem with you saying that the water here, even though it's connected to Tumah somehow, is pure? What are they attacking them for?
What they said is that there's no logic with the Pharisees. It's doesn't make sense. Like, why would you say that? So the sadness of saying, well, what we're saying is more logical. You know,
right.
That what's the difference if it's connected, you know, in a sense by like above and below, or like what's the difference?
Right. In other words, right. So what? So first of all, what are the Sadducees concerned with? You mentioned it, but what is the topic of what the Sadducees are concerned with here? Purity. Again, purity. And as per Sally, what are they saying the Pharisees are doing? The Pharisees, again, are ignoring the expected way in which purity and impurity interact. In other words, if I asked you, set aside all the technical considerations that we've just enumerated. If I asked you, if you have a legal system that recognizes categories like purity and impurity, and something that is pure touches something that is impure, what happens? What happens to the thing that's pure? It becomes impure. It's just logical. In other words, it makes very good sense to say that any time impurity touches purity, the whole thing is impure now. That's the nature of impurity. So what the Sadducees are saying, in effect, to the Pharisees is the same thing that we saw in the previous two arguments. They are saying, you are disregarding the way in which purity and impurity, tumah v'tahara, should be expected to work. Just as we said with the books of Tanakh and the books of Homer. In other words, you would expect that the books of Tanakh should be pure, whereas the books of Homer should be impure. So too here. Anytime pure impurity comes into contact with purity, anytime we have tumah come into contact with Tara, we should expect that the whole thing should be tame, should be impure.
Sorry, I can't buy that.
On what grounds?
Why shouldn't purity cleanse impurity? Make people anoint.
Oh, that may be true. That may be true.
Why does it have to work the way you're saying it?
That may be true, but that's nonetheless that seems to be the Sadducees' position. That what their problem is that the rabbis are making something, are saying that something is pure when in fact it's not. It may be. Obviously, the Pharisees disagreed with the Sadducees. Yes.
The Pharisees are much more practical.
Right. So what we've seen in the previous case is, again, that they are practical. Now, why do you say that? I think you're right. But why do you say that based on this source?
If the whole water system became impure,
exactly.
You'd be dead.
Right. The problem is here, we're discussing an amas mayim. We're discussing a mikvah. But as we know from rabbinic sources, the same principles would apply to a canal, right? To a water hole. To all of these cases where, conceptually, we know that there is impure water mixed into water that the Torah says is pure. So what the Pharisees have done is said to the Sadducees, again, two things. Number one, you can't render impure all of our water sources just because there might be tumah. Just because there might be tumah somewhere in the Mediterranean Sea, can't say that the whole Mediterranean Sea is therefore impure. That would be ridiculous, number one. Number two, they are pointing out that your entire conception of how tumah v'tahara works is incorrect, as Malvina was saying. Just because there is impurity here, why do we assume that the impurity ruins the entire structure of purity? Again, you're thinking about tumah v'tahara in a non-analytical or non-sufficiently analytical fashion.
Very logical, like just pure logic.
Right. In other words,
these are pure logic.
Right. Exactly.
Exactly. Like literally.
Oh, I hadn't thought about that.
The way that you would intuit.
Right. In other words, they're making
these. They're not being practical, but they're being very logical.
Right, and in fact, what they're doing is, I think their view, it's not only that they're logical, which is important. In other words, they're trying to come at this via logic. What the Pharisees are doing is saying that your logic is reified. In other words, your logic is too simplistic, and it's not helpful for use in analyzing halacha and analyzing Jewish texts.
How much of this also plays into the disagreement?
In what respect? In what respect? Right. So just to address that really quickly, and then we're going to skip to source number 7 for the interest of time. To address that question, it's actually interesting. Josephus says the following about the Sadducees and Pharisees. He says, the Pharisees abided by the traditions of the fathers, and the Sadducees did not, preferring only what is written in Scripture. Now, people have a tendency, I think, to analyze history in light of their present circumstances. So, for example, people normally assume that Karaites, who rejected the oral law, that the Karaites must have been big Mechilim, right? They must have been very lenient. Why must they have been very lenient? People normally assume that because they look at people today who are not, let's say, Orthodox Jews, and they perceive that they're living rather more lenient lifestyles than a person who is Orthodox or ultra-Orthodox. So I think that's the general perception. So they assume the Karaites must have lived in a similar fashion. The fact of the matter is that the Karaites were incredibly stringent upon themselves, far more so in many cases than rabbinic Jews. In turn, I think many of the Rishonim assumed that the Sadducees must also have rejected any sense of interpreting the Torah other than in its strictest sense. The reason I think they assume this is because that's what the Karaites did. In other words, the Karaites were sort of textual fundamentalists, so they thought that they were. So the Sadducees must have also been textual fundamentalists. So they have a tendency to read Josephus in that light. So when Josephus says they preferred only what was written in Scripture, they thought that what that must have meant is that they were sort of textual literalists. We know from sources like the Dead Sea Scrolls and from other sources that this is not true. The Sadducees would not have rejected something just because it wasn't written literally and explicitly in Scripture. What they objected to are these traditions of the fathers that the Pharisees espoused. Now, Josephus doesn't say anything about Torah Shabbat Peh, Halachos and Moshe Mitzvah, or any of that sort of thing. Those are all terms that appear and crop up later in Chazal to describe phenomena that earlier didn't have real terminology. What Josephus is likely talking about, this is an interesting digression, I think, that we could develop at a different time. What he's talking about are these traditions that are not written in Scripture, that people, not just Pharisees, that people observed in general. They just didn't have a basis in Psukim. Rabbi Akiva comes along later and anchors all of these things in Psukim. That's sort of the project of Rabbi Akiva. But these are old traditions that the Pharisees are in possession of. So it doesn't mean that the Sadducees would sort of have rejected these sort of interpretations of Psukim based on rules like Kal Vachomer or Gzeres HaKasuv or rather Gzeres Shava, that sort of thing. The Sadducees likely, if the Dead Sea Scrolls, if any of them are Sadducean, we know that they use those same hermeneutical tools. What they rejected was this one specific element of Pharisaic thought, which is these ancient traditions. But as we can see here, they also rejected other things. They didn't just think the Pharisees were crazy because they observed all of these traditions that weren't written in the Torah. They also thought that they were crazy because they weren't respecting what would seem to be, to them at least, the intuitive, logical rules of Tumah V'Taharah and holiness and non-holiness. So now, just in the interest of time, what I want to show you is that this is not just sort of a portrayal of the Pharisees that is found in Chazal, in rabbinic literature. It's also found elsewhere when people critique the Pharisees, namely in the New Testament. Take a look at source number 7. Source number 7 is from Matthew 23. Matthew 23, which was composed likely in about the last decade or two of the first century of the Common Era. Matthew 23 contains a long polemic that Jesus issues against the Pharisees. The whole thing is just an attack on the Pharisees. Some of it has been augmented by later writers, but we can sort of recover the original. In many cases, we don't even need to assume that. We can just recover the original text. So take a look at source number 7. Source number 7 contains the following critique of the Pharisees. "Woe to you, blind guides." Blind guides are the Pharisees. They're mentioned explicitly in several parts of the text. "Woe to you, Pharisees, who say..." Now, by the way, recall, this is almost exactly kovlamatem prushim, rather. "We protest against you, O Pharisees." The same rhetoric is being used here. "Woe to you, Pharisees, who say, if anyone swears by the temple, it is nothing. But if anyone swears by the gold of the temple, he is bound by his oath. You blind fools, which is greater, the gold or the temple that has made the gold sacred? And you say, if anyone swears by the altar, it is nothing. But if anyone swears by the sacrifice on the altar, he is bound by his oath. You blind men, for which is greater, the gift or the altar that makes the gift sacred?" Now, again, as a matter of rhetoric, what sort of argument is Jesus making? Now, just to recap, in the case of a carbon, let's say, we know it's a principle in Chazal. If a person takes a shvuah, if a person takes an oath and says, "I will do X, Y, and Z," and he does so, it depends what sort of formulation you use. This is all in Nedarim and in Shvuos. But if you use, let's say, a formulation that sounds sort of like an oath but isn't the formal language, so you just say, I swear that I will do X, Y, and Z," and you take that oath by the Mizbeach, Chazal say, nothing. The Pharisees say, It's not an oath at all. You're not bound by it. But if you take an oath and say, I swear to do X and X by a karban, or in the terminology of Chazal, konam, if you use the word karban or konam, in that case, if you say, I will do such and such by a sacrifice, then your oath is binding. Then your oath is binding. Now, Jesus makes the following argument here. If a sacrifice, if in other words, if an oath on a karban is a binding oath, then certainly an oath on the altar should be a binding oath. Why? Because a sacrifice is just a sacrifice. But an altar is what makes a sacrifice holy. In other words, you can't bring a sacrifice outside of, you can't have shchudei chutz, you can't bring a sacrifice outside of the temple. So if a sacrifice on an altar, if an oath on a sacrifice is a good oath, then certainly an oath on the altar itself should be a good oath. What sort of argument is this? It's also a form of a kal vachomer, and it's being made against the Pharisees. And moreover, what is the intellectual content of the argument? What are they arguing in both cases? The gold of the temple versus the temple, and the product of the altar versus the altar itself. What is the argument they're making against the Pharisees, Jesus?
Holiness.
Superficiality, right? In other words, what is Jesus saying? What should be more holy? The temple, the altar. And instead, what do the rabbis say? What do the Pharisees say?
They're saying the gold, but it should be the temple.
Right, they're saying the gold really should be the temple. They're saying the sacrifice, really it should be the altar. So again here, the common attack on the Pharisees, not just in the Mishnah, not just by the Sadducees, but also by Jesus himself, is that the Pharisees are, again, upending, mixing up the proper boundary between holy and unholy.
And
right, and he goes on to say that in the rest of the chapter, right.
It's not just a kavamor, but it's also a put-down, in a sense.
Right. So actually, now that you mention that, let's quickly look at source number 8, which I think develops that exactly. Source number 8 says, "Woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites." Now, again, kol mano aleichem prushim. We protest against you, O Pharisees. Why? For you clean the outside of the cup and the plate, but inside they are full of greed and self-indulgence. You blind Pharisee. First clean the inside of the cup and the plate, that the outside also may be clean. There's a Pharisaic and also rabbinic law that when it comes to certain types of less severe impurity, namely water impurities, that are not, from the point of view of the Pharisees, Torah law. So if they touch the outside of a vessel, rather if they touch the outside of a vessel, only the outside is impure, but the inside is saved. In other words, normal liquids that come into contact with even with a dead body, unless it's secreted by a dead body. Let's say water that comes into contact with a dead body. It's not impure on a biblical level. The rabbis decreed that it would be impure on a rabbinical level, but the difference is that it can only render impure the outside of the cup. So what is Jesus saying here? Jesus is saying, essentially, the inside of the cup is the most important part. Why? Because that's what you use. So how can you say that the outside is impure, but the inside is fine? And what he ties it to is exactly what Andy is saying. The inside is all impure. In other words, when the rabbis say the outside is impure, but the inside is fine, so what does that mean? All you have to do is take care of the outside, but the inside you can leave as is. So Jesus says that the Pharisees are the same way. They make the outside look pretty, and the inside is all rotten to the core. So again, you're right, it is a moral argument that Jesus makes against the Pharisees. But again, what we see here is the Pharisees are being critiqued for upending the rules, what we would have thought should be the rules of Tumah V'Tahara. In other words, you think that only the outside should be impure, but the inside should be fine. It doesn't make sense. The inside is the most important part. So if anything's going to be Tameh, if anything's going to be ruined when it comes into contact with impurity, it should be the most important part, the inside. So the Pharisees, again, are being accused of misunderstanding these things. Now, the Gospels, of course, this is one of the great virtues of rabbinic literature. And in fact, Chazal articulate this explicitly. Why do we pasuk, parenthetically, why do we pasuk like Beis Hillel over Beis Shammai? Why did Chazal tell us? Because Beis Hillel always gave pride of place to the opinions of their opponents over their own opinions, as a matter of intellectual honesty. They always made sure that their opponents had a hearing. That is a salient and defining characteristic of rabbinic literatures. They always give a hearing to their opponents, a fair hearing. The Gospels don't allow the Pharisees to respond here, so we don't know what they would have said to this. But based on the analogy to the Mishnah Yadayim, and with this we'll conclude, we can well imagine what the Pharisees would have said. What the Pharisees would have said is that you are approaching this simplistically, and you are approaching this in a way that A, ignores practical realities, and B, isn't even very good analysis of Torah law. When it comes to the Sadducees, there are two things that they ignore as well. The practical reality. In other words, if we say that all human bones are going to be pure just because it seems like that should be the case, then what's going to happen? People are going to start taking their parents' bones and making them into forks, knives, and spoons. If we say that a servant, just because he's a human and he's better than an animal, that therefore we should have to pay for all of his damages as well, what's going to happen? He can go around burning down everybody's houses and get off scot-free. It can't be. E-Epsha. It cannot be. It's completely impractical. This, I will argue, is, in a subsequent class, is pillar one of why the Pharisees and eventually the rabbis survive through antiquity and become dominant. And then eventually, of course, into the medieval period, because they are willing to adapt and embrace the practical realities of life around them. But, and I believe more importantly, the other response that the Pharisees give to their Sadducean interlocutors, and that I believe they must have given when Jesus challenged them, is that you are misunderstanding how these categories work. You assume, in this sort of Manichaean, I think simplistic fashion, Sadducees, that if something is very important, it must be pure. If something is very unimportant, it must be impure. If something has impurity mixed into it, any body of water that has impurity mixed into it, it must be all impure. And how could you say otherwise? How could you gainsay this? The Pharisees say, no. Torah, lamdus, studying our traditions, is a far more complex proposition than this. Far more complex. There are some cases where Tumah Vatara should not work like that. The holy books, Tanakh, should be impure precisely because we value them. Some water that has impurity mixed in isn't impure. How do we know? The Torah says the mikveh is pure. There are certain cases where, if we're studying the law in a fair fashion, these very comfortable concepts can come crumbling to the ground. So there are two things that emerge from this, and this is the last 10 seconds before we conclude. There are two implications of this, and they're paradoxical, which is of course appropriate for the worldview of the Pharisees. One is that if we're going to analyze how halacha works, how hashkafa works, how our theology should pan out, we have to do so by examining the full complexity of what the Torah has to offer us. We can't come in with these dichotomous, Manichaean, black and white, light and darkness concepts and simply impose them upon the Torah. We can't assume that because we think we understand how Tumah Vatara should work, that therefore all the data should fall that way. When we examine the Torah, it represents an independent construct, and we have to analyze it as such. We have to analyze it without any intellectual blinders. We have to examine it without preconceptions, on the one hand. And on the other hand, we also have to be aware of practical reality. Part and parcel of Torah law is that it adapted to the societies of which it was a part. The society of the era that in which it was composed, in which the various books were composed, and of course the societies, the variegated societies of the future that it would need to address. The Torah is first and foremost received divine wisdom that is meant to be understood within the context of the human experience. And therefore, when we analyze Chumash, when we analyze Navi, when we analyze the texts of Chazal, we have to be aware that they must be understood within the context of their current sociocultural, socio-religious realities. So, paradoxically, Torah needs to represent for us an independent construct that needs to be analyzed without preconceptions, without looking over our shoulder to the society that lies behind us, and at the same time, as an inherent product of that society that it emerged from. And I think that this is all too appropriate for our class, for what we are attempting to do here, analyzing the sources on their own merits, but also being aware that they come from a specific background, that they come from a specific place, and they need to be analyzed as such, with due attention paid to history, to archaeology, and epigraphy. And as we'll see in subsequent classes, this is a crucial hermeneutic, this sort of paradox for understanding how the Pharisees prospered and how the rabbis eventually triumphed. Yeshua Kamach, and have a good evening.